Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. And our guest for tonight is James Anthony. He's a prosecutor out in Oakland, California. And we'll bring him in here in just a moment. I want to thank you all for your participation in last week's fundraising effort. It was our honor to bring in 5,000 in half an hour. And that was really exciting. If any of you other stations out there think that we could help your efforts during the pledge season, you be sure and let me know. Get in touch with Dean at drugtruth.net. I'd be glad to participate. And again, I was mentioning our guest for the evening is James Anthony. He's a prosecutor out in Oakland, California. And he's involved in the prosecution of some of these drug houses, if you will. Let's go ahead and bring him on board. Hello, James. Can you hear me, sir?
California, can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine, sir. Welcome. Welcome. I'm glad you could be with us today.
Well, first of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be on the show and to have this opportunity to give my perspective. So thank you, Mr. Becker. Let me just state for the record, I am out here in Oakland, California, where the sun is going down on a beautiful, warm day. And it is true, I work for the city attorney's office. I'm not a district attorney. I don't bring any criminal actions, but I do bring civil prosecutions against drug houses. It's a form of seizure under state law. But I'm here, of course, on the show, not on behalf of the city, but as a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, an organization that perhaps your listeners are familiar with and that I joined just in the last few weeks.
Well, James, you join thousands who have, joined up with LEAP this year, following, I think, you know, some really, really great groundwork by Jack Cole, Peter Crist, and a bunch of others to bring about an association of people who've been in the trenches of the drug war and who found it to be a bad policy and are wanting to talk about it. Let's talk about the work you do, the prosecuting work that you do at this time.
Sure. You know, I didn't set out in law school to become a drug prosecutor. I got out of law school just a few years ago in 1999. I went to what counts as a fairly progressive, well-ranked law school, the University of California at Davis, also known as King Hall, named after Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And I did, however, in my law school career, get involved in law enforcement for what I saw as the public good. As a law student, I did clerk in the district attorney's office in the Consumer and Environmental Protection Unit. I worked on some bad loans. There was quite a rash of these unscrupulous lenders coming through making predatory loans to senior citizens in the poorer neighborhoods of Oakland, which somehow, you know, after the balloon payment, they would end up taking the houses of these senior citizens. It was quite scandalous. I also worked on some false advertising involving the phone company, what used to be Pacific Bell and is now SBC and is now AT&T, where we got a $20 million fine. So I am a believer in law enforcement as a tool for social good. And so when I was offered this job in the city of Oakland in what's called the Neighborhood Law Corps, I could really see that this was something that I could get behind. The salary is fairly low. I actually have a nonprofit salary, although I do have an office in the city. It was on a two-year contract. And the point of the Neighborhood Law Corps was to address community problems, poor neighborhoods problems, from the community perspective, but using the prosecutorial powers of the city attorney's office. So on a good day, I address issues like slumlords, blight, pollution, the kind of consumer scams that I mentioned earlier, and I'm quite happy suing a slumlord. Where things got a little more morally challenging for me was when my client, the police department, started bringing me, as did community members, issues of drug dealing and drug houses in the poorer neighborhoods of Oakland. And because of the position I'm in and have been in for the last 2.5 years, I took a law enforcement approach to those properties. Now, it's one thing if it's a 50-unit apartment building that's owned by a absentee landlord who's just not managing the property and it's out of control and it's very dangerous, and it seems like the immediate solution is that I should bring some legal pressure to bear on that owner and cause him to manage that property in a more responsible way. That's one thing. Where it gets really rough is when the police officers have a drug problem in a house, but they can't put either the teenagers or the young adults or who have you who's involved in the drug activity, they don't seem to be able to put them away in jail, so then they want me to sue the grandmother who owns the house and eliminate the property as a location for that drug activity. And that's where I've had my most difficult cases in terms of my own personal standing. And I will say, Dean, that this year I sued a 94-year-old African-American woman whose 50-year-old daughter had been selling heroin for 20 years in North Oakland. And why it is exactly that the police weren't able to deal with that on a criminal basis is, I think, a fairly complicated story, and I don't even really know. The rumors I heard was that the heroin dealer herself would cut deals with the district attorney to become an informant on other parts of this chain of commerce, and so consequently, you know, the different factions of law enforcement were not able to get together to solve that problem, and they came to me to sue her 94-year-old mother and cause her to sell the house. And if that isn't sufficiently outrageous, they also asked me initially to collect $125,000 in police overtime from the proceeds of that sale. Now, I brought that down to what I considered on balance to be a more reasonable amount, but some of money did change hands in that transaction. So when I encountered law enforcement against prohibition recently, what they were saying made a lot of sense to me, that the war on drugs, while there is a problem, the war itself is not working. There's no evidence that it's working, and it does have a corrupting influence on law enforcement.
James, I want to say something here. Something caught my attention. You mentioned $125,000 in overtime that they wanted reimbursed. Yep. And that's to say they have, if you'll excuse, been so inept or incompetent or somehow unable to bust this person, but they've invested that much time. It says a whole lot about the other side of the equation, the actual ability to control these drugs.
Well, you know, as we sit here, I'm looking at my computer screen. One of the things I have up here is the war on drugs clock, which gives you a graphic accounting of the amount of money spent on the war on drugs federally and by the states. And you can just see these dollars ticking away. We're up to $18 billion this year on the federal side, almost $28 billion among the states, a total of almost $46 billion. And, you know, being a police officer is a dangerous job in Oakland. They're well paid. They're unionized. They're entitled to their overtime when they're on the clock. But it doesn't speak well for the efficacy of the law enforcement approach to reducing drug activity. There's been no reduction in drug activity throughout my lifetime, and yet we continue to expend more and more resources, not only financial resources, but human lives are ruined on both sides, both those who end up in prison and even those who wear the badge and are sworn to serve and protect and uphold and defend. They don't necessarily feel that this is the best way to go about that. And yeah, if you look at the money, it makes no sense at all.
Well, I do understand, and this, I'm not asking you to speak on this necessarily, but Oakland and San Francisco have shown through circumstance, through years of implementation of that Prop 215, that though adults have an easier time getting marijuana for medical reasons, children are using it less, and it hasn't created any other turmoil, any other side issues because of that Prop 215. There is a better way, is there not?
It would seem that, and I think here if we look internationally, the best example of, you know, well, what about the kids? Because LEAP is very clear that, you know, what we're looking for in an end to the war on drugs is to bring drugs inside the law where we can control them and keep them away from kids. And the best example with a substance like marijuana would have to be Amsterdam, where everybody understands clearly they have amongst the lowest teenage marijuana use of any place in the Northern Hemisphere, because marijuana is just boring to them. It's something that tourists do. You know, the tourists come in from Germany or England or America or wherever, and they go to these cafes and they do this thing. And, you know, why would you want to be associated with something that a bunch of boring tourists are doing? It's just not interesting to them. I think the example inside the United States that I use is that the one drug that I have seen a successful reduction in the use of in our lifetime is tobacco. When I was a kid, tobacco was everywhere. It was, you know, at hand height on adults. They were all holding a cigarette. They're liable to put your eye out. There were ashtrays everywhere in the house. I remember going to baseball games. Everybody smoking and throwing those things around. And that was just accepted as reality. And that's completely changed now, at least here in California. I do occasionally smoke tobacco. My six-year-old daughter has no idea. You know, people are very clear that it's limited, and it's not because it's been made illegal. It's because of the social stigma and because people are employing their own form of harm reduction in their own personal lives, controlling their habits, bringing it down, and just socially, it's just not acceptable. And that, I think, it teaches us something, that the way to control these substances is to put them under control where we can handle them legally and with social stigma and with information so that everybody knows what the dangers are.
Well, James, let me ask you this. You have had this term with Oakland, and how do the other officers feel? I mean, water cooler talk. Is there any discussion about the policies of this drug war, you know, behind the curtain, so to speak?
Sure. I mean, and it's interesting you should mention that, because as I will be leaving the city at the end of December as my contract expires, I've been trying to think, you know, how do I want to continue this conversation with my colleagues, both the other attorneys, city staff, sworn officers. In a place like Oakland, people are pretty savvy. And what we had here recently, it's interesting that you mentioned medical marijuana. We had a city initiative that was passed with 87,000 votes last year, which is 65% of the voters. And basically what that initiative does is it makes private adult marijuana use the lowest law enforcement priority for the Oakland Police Department. That has nothing to do with medicine. It is basically a private adult recreational use policy that the police department is just not going to go after that. Now, what we're seeing within the city is that there is some hesitancy to implement that by elected politicians and city staff. And I will take them at their word. And what they say publicly is that their objection, really what it boils down to, is that the measure is not radical enough. And what they would like to see is a statewide legalization of marijuana and perhaps of other drugs. And so I encourage people in the city, you know, when they object to that specific local measure, to go ahead and do the thinking and flesh out, you know, what is your ideological position and how is it consistent? And in doing so, you can get the people who work in the city in all those positions I mentioned really to take that much more a far-reaching systemic approach. Now, you could call that radical, I don't know, but it makes more sense to legalize all drugs at a state level than it does to try to decriminalize a particular favorite drug at a local level. And Oakland, I'm proud to say, is the kind of city where I can have that kind of frank discussion, usually in a private forum, although, you know, publicly that was the objection to that initiative, Measure Z.
Well, I think it's important that people realize the progress that's been made in California. Again, there has been no backlash from Prop 215. It's been reported that perhaps even fewer children are using since its implementation. And it's okay to at least talk about change. It's okay to, project other alternatives.
Really, for California, marijuana is rapidly becoming a no-brainer. In the San Francisco Chronicle this past Sunday, in the business section, mind you, the business section, the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle business section, their business editorialist, whose work I'm familiar with because he's a frequent critic of the utilities and other consumer abusers, fellow by the name of David Lazarus. Lazarus, for the Chronicle, as their business editorialist, says, legalize marijuana, regulate it, and tax it. That on marijuana alone, California would save $1 billion. $1 billion, California alone, marijuana law enforcement. And could easily make $100 million in taxation and regulatory fees. Now, California, just to put that in context, you know, our budget is never quite balanced. I don't know whose is. California's budget is running a deficit of about $2 to $3 billion. So through the simple device of legalizing, regulating, and taxing marijuana, we could eliminate over half of the deficit for one state.
It's so entrenched, is it not? I mean, I'm sure even amongst your colleagues in private, you can talk about this, but it's another thing to step forward publicly, as you have done, while still serving as a prosecutor. We have several members of LEAP who speak up while they're still wearing the badge or holding the job of authority. How difficult was it for you to speak in this regard?
Well, you know, I'm lucky. For one thing, I feel that I stand on the shoulders of giants. When I met the founders of LEAP, most of whom, as I think you mentioned, are retired still, they're very, very inspiring. And I feel like, you know, I'm not just one guy standing out there. There are lots of us. We are everywhere. And what I'm looking forward to doing on the other side is not lobbying politicians, but organizing common folk. Because the people in my neighborhoods, in the poor neighborhoods where I work really as a community organizer, they are scared, and they have every right to be scared. A black market creates violence and scary people making huge profits, you know, on a substance of very little social value. And I want to go back to those people, the people in the neighborhoods, and open a dialogue with them for how we systemically address their concerns and their fears. Because change will come from them. It'll come from people like the other members of LEAP. It's not going to come initially, maybe not for a long while, from our elected officials. They will follow. They will not lead on this issue. And so, you know, I've been lucky. I've been able to speak out. I know that the people who will remain inside may or may not be able to do that. But I think as this possibility even of discussing the war on drugs has failed, what are our alternatives? As that's in the newspaper, in the business section, in the letters to the editors, in the Crime Watch community meeting that people take time out of their busy week to come and meet together and discuss issues of their block. As that becomes more common, it'll just get easier and easier for all of us to stand up and do what needs to be done. And America is a country that I think tends to go all the way, that we won't do half measures, that we won't merely decriminalize, that we won't settle for a kind of European compromise. If Americans decide that we would be better off ending drug prohibition than just as we ended alcohol prohibition, we will completely end drug prohibition. We will legalize all drugs. We will see that it's handled medically, that it's handled by social workers, that we undo some of the harm that has been done over the decades of prohibition. So I'm actually very hopeful about that.
Well, I tell you what, we've got just a minute or two left here. I want to, first off, remind folks they can learn more about this organization, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, by visiting their website, which is at leap.cc. That's LEAP.cc. James, you have attended the recent Drug Policy Alliance conference along with, I think it was 800-plus others. What was your take? What are people talking about amongst these many organizations? There seems to be a bit of a cohesiveness these days. What do you think?
Let me tell you, Dean, that was a very inspiring gathering to me. And it was inspiring because coming from Oakland and from California, relatively enlightened, and yet who are the main visible organizers against drug prohibition, against the war on drugs here? It's basically, it could be summed up as old hippies. Now, that's fine. That it's important that they've been leading this fight for so long. But when I got to that conference and walked into that room that first night, I realized that we are legion. We are everywhere. There were over 50 retired police officers there. There were senior citizens. There were college students from all across the nation, co-eds from the Midwest, the nice farm girls from Wisconsin. There were formerly incarcerated persons. There is a felon civil rights movement in this country that is gathering strength. And when you have the formerly incarcerated and the police on the same side of a social issue, pushing in the same direction with the churches, really, I would say the only significant group that I didn't feel was represented there that really needed to be there is labor. And I look forward to the unions coming on board. But the breadth of that conference and the breadth of this movement, it's in every walk of life now. And that is what gives me the optimism that America will see that what we've been doing is not working and we need to do something different. As Ethan Nadelman said at that conference, and I think he really nailed it on the head, who are we in the drug reform movement? We are people who love drugs. We are also people who hate drugs, who have seen the destructive power of drugs and want to bring that under control. And we are people who don't care about drugs, people who are concerned about other social issues that have been ignored while enormous resources have been wasted on a pointless war on drugs. And that conference really brought it together for me. It's not just the old hippies anymore.
Wow. Hey, James, thank you so much for being our guest here on Cultural Baggage. I do appreciate it, sir. Hope you've had a wonderful Thanksgiving season here, and do stay in touch.
Thank you very much, Mr. Becker. I so greatly appreciate the work you do. I'm looking at your webpage, and please do keep in touch and keep up the good work.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Good night now.
You know, a lot of folks don't realize this, but certain few people here in the United States have the government grow marijuana for them and ship them a tin of 300 joints every few weeks. I did an interview recently, and let's go ahead and play that now.
You see the scene on Cops or other TV shows. The cops bust in the door and there's 100 kilos stacked against the wall. Well, the truth be told, agents of the federal government monthly give amounts to a stockbroker down in Florida, and now it's totaled up to 100 kilos of cannabis, reefer, marijuana, grown in Mississippi and distributed to stockbroker Irv Rosenfeld. That's amazing. 220 pounds provided by the U.S. government?
Yes, and counting.
Well, tell us about how that works. What is this all about?
Right. I'm a compassionate care patient under the federal government, under the United States federal government. The last 23 years, the federal government's been supplying me 11 ounces of marijuana every 25 days for severe bone disorder. I use the marijuana for muscle relaxant, anti-inflammatory, and for pain. The protocols were shut down in 1992 by George Bush Sr. when they found that it worked for AIDS patients. We were able to basically take the protocols and mass produce them, and so thousands of patients applied for the beyond the compassionate care protocols, and the Bush administration, not wanting to deal with it, shut it down. And that grant, they grandfathered us in, so we didn't sue them. So today there are only 7 people in the United States receiving medical cannabis from the federal government.
I know you're much involved in trying to open the discourse to provide information in this regard. What's the latest you've been doing?
I testified in Wisconsin before a House committee for medical marijuana. They're bringing up a bill again to try to allow physicians in Wisconsin to make recommendations for medical cannabis for different patients and different diseases, and basically take the crime away from it. So this was one of the beginning hearings, and so I've looked at a testifying.
There's also talk that perhaps we could return to the bygone days when cannabis was a registered medicine provided by pharmacists, recommended by doctors. What's happening in that regard?
Yes, it could. In our country, marijuana was legal from 1860 to 1937. Today, there's a company in England called GW Pharmaceuticals, which has made, taken and grown natural cannabis and then made a mucosal spray, a spray that you spray underneath your tongue. It's illegal in Canada. It's now being allowed to be prescribed in England for any disorder, for any physician and any patient. And they are talking, I do know, they are talking with trying to get something going in this country. I do believe that the cannabis works. I'm living proof of that. And to be able to put in a sublingual spray would make it to where the pharmaceutical company could then actually market the liquid cannabis.
Okay. Here in just a second, I want to play one of our reports from the Houston-based Mr. Phil Jackson, who does the Black Perspective for us.
And now another Black Perspective on the drug war. The Millions More movement, that was truly an inspiration. And the theme of organizing our communities in order to take care of our own issues was very empowering. On the issue of the drug war, several specific goals were put forward, and you can read them all on the webpage of the Million Family March National Agenda. But I want to take a look at a couple of them. Now, there's a fundamental difference between the interests of the criminal justice system and those of the Black community. The drug war has resulted in huge numbers of arrests for possession. But the growers, processors, importers, distributors, bankers, and corrupt government and law enforcement officials not only operate with relative impunity, but live large on the flow of dirty money. That's why one of our goals must be to refocus federal resources to target and punish large-scale drug smugglers, suppliers, and distributors, and propose enhanced sentences for law enforcement personnel convicted of drug-related offenses. Maybe putting some of these collar dealers and uniformed drug thugs not just into the prisons, but under them, would be a step in the right direction. In fact, the only thing these corrupt big fish fear more than prison is legalization. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
I hope you begin to get the picture, my friends. But it really ends this, the end game of the drug war will come from you. A couple of program notes. Next week I'm headed to Seattle and then to Vancouver. Gonna go up and see Mark Emery, see if my passport will get me across. Gonna come back to Seattle and attend the Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs Conference. This is an international conference that should begin to pull the lid off of this ugly situation. Want to point out that, you know, we do the DOT Award, which is $1,200 cash money to any drug warrior, police captain or above, any agent, DEA, CIA, Justice Department, or FBI, any district attorney or judge willing to come on the show and tell us of the need for drug war. We're now going to offer the DASH Award, which basically is $100 every month for the best essay written to dean@drugtruth.net, and we'll select the best one each month. We'll record you. We'll put you over the airwaves of the Drug Truth Network. What we're going to do is allow folks to participate, if they believe the drug war is a good thing, to speak of the positives involved.
If you're interested in trying to do something to help end the madness of the drug war, I urge you to visit our new website, endprohibition.org. There you will find many links that make it possible to hook up with your congressman or your senator and the best of the drug reform groups.
And as always, my friends, I guess we're about to run out of time, but I want to remind you, because of drug prohibition, you really don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.